Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly jolt of libertarianism, brought to you by the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, our spiritual leader, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Everyone.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Monday, and I just want to say I don't really believe in spiritualism or leadership.
It's fair.
Okay. We're going to...
Did it die with Ecto Cooler High C, Peter? That's when you realized it was all a scam.
Man, I had a Midori sour cocktail that was called like an Ecto Cooler sour or something the other day. Great cocktail bar in DC. Just wonderful. So green. Good stuff.
As Prince sang, your body's ecto slamming. We're going to get to the deep waters of SCOTUS here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsors, Students for Liberty.
The most important ideas are those debated on college campuses. Think about how many different fringe concepts initially spawned in the academy that are now prevalent across society. F.A. Hayek noticed this phenomenon. The ideas developed in academia soon spread to the rest of society. That's why Students for Liberty supports students like me in spreading the ideas of liberty on campuses. As a coordinator with SFL, I've hosted high-profile speakers to discuss the pressing issues of the day, published magazines and articles to spread pro-liberty ideas, and helped organize and attend conferences on campuses around the world. SFL connected me with partner organizations, and thanks to SFL, I've been accepted to internships at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, National Review, the Cato Institute, and will start as an assistant editor at Reason Magazine this summer. My name is Jack Nicastro, and I'm one of the thousands of volunteers from the SFL network building a freer future for people across the globe. Visit spreadliberty.org to discover how you can contribute to building a freer future at school and beyond.
Okay, we're getting into the final days of the Supreme Court's 2023 to 2024 session. I can't wait, by the way, until we're like in a different decade, because it's really hard to say those numbers all the time. It's just like, it gets confusing. Anyways, this means that we're going to see and have been seeing a bunch of controversial decisions of significance, unsubtle attempts to work the refs, and of course, some super awful journalistic commentary thereof, hopefully not including on this podcast. Last week's files included a unanimous rejection of standing in a case filed by opponents of the abortion pill mifepristone. I prefer the Italian mifepristone, Nick. And a more partisanly divided 6-3 reversal of former president Donald J. Trump's ban on bump stocks, which the majority ruled, amounted to the administrative state making policy that Congress never approved. All of this comes at a time of ongoing, quite one-sided journalistic scrutiny of the court's conservative majority, including a sting operation secret audio tape of Justice Samuel Alito nodding along to some gal pretending to be an evangelical culture warrior of some sorts, or Catholic, conservative culture warrior. Catherine, let's start with the abortion pill ruling, otherwise known as the Food and Drug Administration versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. What does that do and not do? Why is it funny at all? And perhaps what does it or does not or won't, whatever, portend for the future?
So this is a case where I don't always agree with Brett Kavanaugh, but he really nailed it when he said a desire to make a drug less available for others does not establish standing to sue. Basically, mind your business. And I think that this is an interesting case because the Supreme Court had been asked basically by plaintiffs who neither prescribe nor use a drug to reduce its availability. And quite rightly said, no, thank you. The fact that it took this long to get here, of course, is a sign that abortion politics obviously are super polarized. Everyone wants to be very careful. But in this case, there is a clear-cut answer. It does not mean that there can't be a challenge to the availability of this drug in the future, but actually establishing standing is really tricky. Kavanaugh also said, just because somebody else doesn't have standing to sue does not give these plaintiffs standing to sue. So part of their argument was, well, maybe no one has standing to tell people what to do when they're not involved in that transaction. And the court was like, yeah, maybe, like, maybe no one That's an idea. So in general, a decision that I think was well-founded and one of actually, I would say several, and we'll talk about this during the podcast, that are kind of common sense. Like, it seems like the court is spending a little bit of time this week just explaining very basic stuff to people, like you can't sue about something you're not involved in or in the bump stock ban. It's like, well, like is pushing a trigger, you have to push the trigger. Like there's a lot of that going on. And maybe that's always the way of the Supreme Court. I don't know, but notable this week.
Nick, the Vanity Fair headline on the ruling was, quote, "In surprise move, the Supreme Court decides not to obliterate abortion rights for now." Do you think it's just a matter of time before the Supreme Court indeed obliterates abortion rights? And or in a less kind of extreme way, what are you as a pro-choice feminist worried about when it comes to Supreme Court jurisprudence on this issue?
You know, I'm worried about the restriction of what I think is a fundamental right to bodily autonomy. So what's coming up in Louisiana is will be a challenge to a law that was passed that's going to seek to obliterate access, if not destroy completely, access to these drugs. So, you know, we'll be seeing that. So that's what I worry about, whether it comes from the Supreme Court or someplace else. I hope at some point that we, you know, start to think about what happened when Roe versus Wade was overturned. And I know a lot of people turned to Ruth Bader Ginsburg's, you know, prophecy at the beginning of all of this that Roe v. Wade was a bad decision because it was going to create all kinds of political torment and ferment, et cetera, by taking legislatures out of this, kind of figuring out what is legal and what isn't. In fact, what we're in for a long time is just more and more of the same, state-by-state politics of abortion stuff. And, you know, what's interesting about the abortion pill rulings is that these things can also, you know, they cross state lines, and there's a federal Commerce Clause issue here, and whether or not people, say, living in Louisiana, women, birthing creatures, whatever we're calling them right now, you know, do they have a right to get stuff in the mail that a doctor who, you know, has talked to them, you know, thinks they should have or not. So none of this is going away. I think in this particular instance, and also in the other ruling that we'll talk about briefly, you know, it's good to see that the court is actually very principled for the most part. I mean, they all have their ideological biases or their frameworks. But, you know, when it comes to basic issues of law and process, they seem to be lining up correctly, which is in favor of constitutional process, not, you know, ham-fisted political stuff.
It's really disappointing that they didn't rule that actually the Postal Service is illegal.
It's a matter of time. I hope you mean the band, not the actual functioning of the post office. Peter, what is your sense of picking up on the politics of all of this? And as someone who lives in Washington, even though you're not currently there, as far as I know, what is your sense of Democrats' continued confidence rate that making the defense of abortion access is a successful campaign issue?
Oh, they're very confident. They view this as maybe their single best election issue going into the November elections. And you can just see that in all of the reports about how much money they're going to be pouring into ads, into the way that the Biden administration wants just to talk about this and wants to make this something that they are going to hit Trump with over and over and over again. So I think we're going to hear a lot about this before November.
Catherine, let's move on to bump stocks. The majority in Garland versus Cargill. Not a country record, held that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms tried to pull a fast one by classifying bump stocks as machine guns, to which the explanatory journalism experts over at Vox tweeted out, "The Supreme Court just effectively legalized machine guns." Given your personal expertise in firearms, Catherine, why are Peter's friends at Vox incorrect?
I thought you were going to say, why are Peter's friends in Kentucky psyched, which is another possible yeah. framing for this
why not both?
Question.
Dot org.
Yeah. And to be clear, my friends in Kentucky are psyched.
So before we get into the technical stuff, Catherine, do you push a trigger or pull a trigger? And I realize with a bump stock, I guess it's kind of you're going back and forth.
Yeah,
right?
From now on.
Well, this is a deadlift versus squat question, right? Yeah. Pushes versus pulls. Okay.
I henceforth will only be bumping my triggers thanks to the Supreme Court. So, no, this is like I say, another case where the Supreme Court spent a really, really long time. And some kind of hay was made out of this, including some diagrams were in the findings in the end. Just trying to establish, like, what exactly happens when you are holding a semi-automatic rifle with a bump stock on it, right? Like, this question is what most of this case turned on. And I have to say, I feel like emanating from some of the Supreme Court's writings, this frustration of, like, why is this our job? Maybe I'm just projecting. But there's like a lot of discussion that seems like something that can and should have been settled by so many other parties before it got to these nine idiots, right? So, for instance, the ATF has repeatedly ruled on this question, saying bump stocks do not, in fact, convert a semi-automatic rifle into a machine gun, over and over and over. And then one last time, Trump said, "Are you sure?" And they were like, "Oh, maybe it does." So there's like a very clear paper trail there. Then, of course, this had to, you know, work its way to the court again, somehow without having fully clarified just the fundamental underlying mechanics. I think, again, it's pretty straightforward. Like, the way the law is written is very clear. You have to pull the trigger each time the gun fires. And that's it. That's what the law is written as. And, you know, as the court noted, Congress could write the law a different way. Congress can feel free to write the law based on rate of fire, but that's not what they did. And it's not up to the court to fix that.
I think this is great because it belatedly, and I hope Trump runs on this, remember he was coming in a power to get rid of the administrative state, and he kind of helped that along with this ruling because he's the one.
17-dimensional chess.
Fifth dimensional chess.
I mean, we don't know where it's going to land. He's still just moving his first knight out from behind the pawns. But for me, that was fascinating. Beyond the fact that also it was a 6-3 decision, which is kind of interesting. Not all of the liberal judges were, you know, in lockstep on this. But mostly, you know, if we take the administrative state critique seriously, huzzah. You know, for the Supreme Court on this one. Huzzah, Matt Welch. And I hope this comes back to bite Trump and his partisans on the ass in the way that all of the stuff that Joe Biden and, you know, is doing with immigration or Obama did or George W. Bush. Let's have that discussion about what are the limits of the executive branch and the administrative state.
I really liked the bit that Jacob Sullum wrote up in his great piece for Reason.com. Talked about how in February, the solicitor, the attorney for the government defending the bump stock, admitted that, you know, an expert, somebody who really knows how to fire a gun, could do the same thing with their finger. So if bump stocks are illegal, then somehow or another, that means that, like, hands and fingers, like human body parts, have been banned by the FDA, or not by the FDA, by the ATF. Maybe also by the FDA.
Yeah,
certainly.
But it also, I mean, the other part of it is that there's a logical issue with that, which is that if you can perform that action with your body and any semi-automatic gun, then in theory, any semi-automatic gun also counts as a machine gun under the same definition that was used to ban bump stocks.
Would you say that this decision established the right to bear fingers, Peter?
Ooh, yes. You do what you want with your fingers.
Yeah.
No.
I actually fingers. Really, really loved
something worse than dad jokes.
The Mom desperate. Jokes. I'm trying to get in on the dad joke market. I feel like it's, you know, Father's Day has passed, so it's every man for himself now. I actually really loved the way that the kind of partisan politics of this whole thing played out, right? Because of course Trump wants everyone to forget that it was, you know, the bump stock ban was actually under his administration, but also. Folks on the left want the whole thing to somehow still be evidence that Trump is bad. And so you got this passage in the New York Times. The decision prompted immediate blowback. Democrats seized on it, blaming former President Donald J. Trump and saying both his actions and his nominees on the court were decisive factors in the outcome. I mean, that's true. That's a true paragraph.
Both?
But it's
both sides of the issue were decisive factors.
He
I mean, this makes
thing.
About as much sense as the ATF's position that
correct.
A bump stock makes a gun a machine gun, despite the fact that your finger can also make a gun a machine gun.
Also, a rubber band can make a gun a machine gun.
Man, just ban it all. It's
I mean,
all
that
illegal.
Is, in fact,
no
you have
bands.
Just said the quiet part loud. Like, that is, in fact, what most people on the left would like to do, so.
Nick, did I hear you drawing your pistol out of your holster there?
No.
Okay.
Please, Peter, don't.
Just quickly to invert the question I asked you earlier about abortion rights and the politics thereof. Do you think Democrats are still of the what I think is mistaken belief that being anti-gun is an effective national political issue?
I think Democrats, especially under Joe Biden, are just extremely enthralled to their interest groups. The Democratic Party right now, the official Democratic Party that exists in Washington, is just absolutely a creature of, a product of a bunch of niche, narrow, single issue, or in some cases, kind of mega single issue in terms of just bundling a whole bunch of stuff together and saying it's all the same thing, right? Like, this is the bump stock ban and, you know, support for freeing Palestine are all the same thing, right? And the Democratic Party right now does not have a good strategy for getting out of the grips of those groups and trying to figure out how to just talk to normal people who don't care about them. And you see that with guns, you see that with the economy, you see that with climate change and energy and just all sorts of issues here. And it's a real problem for them going into November.
All right, let's get to the ongoing journalistic campaign against Justice Alito, his wife's flags, Harlan Crow's apparently bottomless supply of gifts and support for Clarence Thomas. And so forth. Catherine, it may surprise you to learn that I am not conservative and
what?
Don't even play one on TV. And yet I...
You're not calling I've yourself an since... economist conservative now, Matt? No, that we're in a...
No, I'm not a doctor, Nick. Mm. But okay. It's been months at least since I have had any other reaction to whatever new story is that isn't just like, la, 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 I can't hear you. This is white noise. It's obviously partisan. Is that a mistake? Am I part of the problem? Is there a there?
You are absolutely part of the problem, but not for this, I would say.
Thank you.
I've had that same reaction. I had actually a more specific reaction to the secret tape, the sting operation news in which, as you say, we had stunning evidence that sometimes at cocktail parties, people politely agree with weirdos who walk up to them in an attempt to make the conversation end sooner. And I've never felt that more, like, I felt that in my bones. Like, this is, if you want to do a sting operation against me, just come up to me at a cocktail party and say some nonsense, and I will be like, that's an interesting perspective.
Hey,
for
Catherine,
sure.
Don't you think the state should exist?
I'll be like, some people do think that, you know, it's, so, I actually, I think many years ago, Matt, it was you who actually gave me the excellent advice when I'm on TV not to nod while other people are talking, because sometimes you're nodding in a kind of affable way and then boom, the host of the show says something bonkers and then there's video of you seeming to agree. That was good advice, and maybe you should offer it to the Supreme Court.
Almost certainly never gave that to you, but I'm happy to take that.
Yeah, so I feel like the big bombshell of this week is people agree politely at cocktail parties, and I'm just not here to change my view about politics or the Supreme Court as a result.
The trick is, if you catch Nick Gillespie or me, but it's more funny with Nick, as most things, and walk up at a cocktail party and say, hey, Nick, do you remember my name?
Sure. You could have a name tag on, and I would say, no, I have no idea.
Well, no, you would say, yeah, slugger.
Yeah, chief, babe.
Nick, I'm going to read you a quote from America's leading centrist, Norm Ornstein, who's the emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and contributing
editor. He's the guy who parachuted down by Joe Biden, right?
I think so. He's contributing editor for The Atlantic magazine. Well done, Jeffrey Goldberg. We're watching you. Contributing editor, though, you know. This is his reaction to the would-be James O'Keefing of Sam Alito. utterly unethical, corrupt, a serial liar, and a radical, lacking every element of judicial temperament, this monster does not... Sorry, Norm. This monster does not belong in civil society, much less on any court, much less on the Supreme Court. Do we need to complete and total shutdown of Norm Ornstein until we can find out what's going on?
Did he think that Sam Alito was talking at the Young Thug trial or something in Atlanta? I don't know. I don't get that.
God.
I
just live stream Young Thug trial, everyone.
It's very good.
It's fantastic.
And it has so many great issues that intersect with Reason stuff, including old. We did videos about rappers getting thrown in jail based on their lyrics like a decade ago. So. I don't think that Sam Alito was merely politely nodding. I think he wants a more godly society, and fuck him on that score. But this,
I mean, he's a Catholic. He's a Catholic.
I know that, but this is
that self-hatred won't
it's not self-hatred. It's emancipation. He and Harrison Butker can go do each other's beards together somewhere. God. Right. But having said that, there's obviously nothing really here. And I think it was in the Reason piece about this, and I'm forgetting who wrote it, because
Billy Binion.
I think it was Chief, a guy named Chief or Buddy, who wrote it for Reason.
It was Emma Stone.
The lady wrote it for the Reason. And John Roberts, who played Patty in his high school production at an all-boys school in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, which remains a thing that should go on his headstone, was caught in a similar situation. And he was like, I worry about some of this kind of stuff. But it's, none of this is serious.
Well, and in fact, the Roberts gotcha was she said, America is a Christian nation and our Supreme Court should be guiding us on this path. Yeah. And he was like, I don't really think we live in a Christian nation. I know a lot of Jews and Muslims who would say not. Yeah. And I think that's fine. Like,
he might be from he's from Indiana. So there's a good chance, like deep in the cornfield somewhere, they were doing like druidic rites, pretending to be Catholic.
I hope so. God, do you understand the joy it would bring me if there is a giant expose that John Roberts is a secret druid? Oh, God. Yeah. This is the America that I want.
Yeah. No, but it's a very good quote.
I want the report on like his Spotify playlists, and one of them is all black metal.
Yes. This is the way.
I wish that was true. That would be. Peter, I've got a conspiratorial sense that you have to now answer.
It's probably true.
Yes, it is true that Bob Woodward is the enforcer of the deep state. We've talked about this. But I don't know. It feels like all this like ProPublica, like drip drip and all this stuff. It's like a run up to something. Like this is in preparation for something. Am I crazy? I mean, just sort of like
an October surprise, yeah. Madwell?
Not an October surprise, but just like we're waiting on the Supreme Court to make some huge decision that we're going to say is utterly compromised by all the stuff we've been warning you about for the last 2.5 years at ProPublica.org, which is a totally neutral, just going to where the facts are organization.
So let me take these questions individually. Are you crazy?
Yes,
absolutely. And that's not independent of the rest of the facts or context of that question. Number two, are they paving the way for something? I think the answer is maybe, but I'm not sure they know what that something is. And so I want to pull us way back, like almost 15 years to the time of the Tea Party, when there was that rant by Rick, whatever his
Santelli.
Name on CNBC or something about how we need a new Tea Party. And 24 hours later, FreedomWorks and some of these other groups, full disclosure, I worked at FreedomWorks for a year before all of this happened. Some of these other groups like had websites up that were like new Tea Party. And that wasn't, sort of the launch of the Tea Party movement as we knew it. None of those groups were planning for that Rick Santelli rant. They weren't planning for that exact moment, but they were just out there sort of like trying to plant the seeds of something that they hoped would eventually blossom into a thing that was kind of like the Tea Party. And they've been trying for years, and most of their efforts didn't work. I think that's probably the case here, because that is how groups like this operate. And you know, there's just this sense on the left that the Supreme Court in the last decade or so, but really since Trump, has become a kind of tool for illegitimate GOP power. And the best case for this is how the handling of the Merrick Garland.
Everyone's Italian. I'm the Supreme Court.
Let's get out of the 2020s and also remove the words Merrick Garland from the lexicon, because it's all too hard to say. The Merrick Garland nomination, right? Like, it wasn't illegal. It wasn't totally out of bounds, but it was quite unusual. It was a sort of classic McConnell procedural tactical maneuver designed to produce an instant political victory and, you know, and sort of reshape the power in Washington. So that's the best case for it. But a lot of it is just that they don't like that the Supreme Court is pretty consistent and pretty consistently has reined in the power of the executive branch in particular. You see that with the bump stock ban, and I think we're going to see it even more when the Chevron decision comes down later this month.
All right, well played. Let's go to our listener email of the week in a moment at least. But first, friends, I've got one word for you. Senolytics. That's right. Senolytics is a class of ingredients discovered over the past decade that could be a bombshell for promoting healthy aging and enhancing your physical prime. Here's how Senolytics work. As we age, everyone, even Nick Gillespie, accumulates senescent cells in their body. Senescent cells cause symptoms of aging: aches and discomfort, slow workout recovery, sluggish mental and physical energy. These zombie cells, just trying to get Peter's attention, are old and worn out, taking up space and nutrients from your healthy cells. But now you can prune these dead cells off your tree of life by taking Qualia Senolytic. Qualia Senolytic is a vegan, gluten-free, non-GMO, for those who celebrate, supplement, and you only need to take it twice a month to remove those zombie cells and halt the barbarians of aging at the cellular gates. So go to neurohacker.com/roundtable right now and get a 100-day money-back guarantee, up to $100 off. And when you use the code roundtable at checkout, which you obviously will, yet another 15% off the ticket price. That's neurohacker.com/roundtable. Attack those zombie cells. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder
to
email.
I want that ad to be read in like the two characters are in a movie and they're listening to the radio and they hear that ad and they're like, we don't need to worry about zombie cells. That seems silly. And then it's a zombie movie. This is the sequel to 28 Days Later that's going to come out. That's the thing you hear in the background and people decide to ignore it.
I think Peter has finally snapped, Nick. I think we got him. Reminder to everyone to email your queries, brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Jonathan Bowler, who writes, "Dear Roundtable, I wanted to at least sort of push back on Joe Lancaster's article of June 12th about the vague noises some Republicans are making about bringing back the draft. While I obviously agree with the core premise that the draft was an abomination that needed to be torn down, there is something I think is way, in all caps, worse, way worse. The blank check this has written since 1972 for various presidents to bomb whoever they want, whenever they want, knowing that they would never face anywhere near the level of backlash for starting a new war as we saw during Vietnam. Am I crazy for thinking that abolishing the draft was probably the greatest gift we could have given the military-industrial complex? I feel like knowing that this war or that war not only won't be your problem, but won't be anyone you actually know and love's problem, makes it way harder to get as angry as we should be about new, pointless, unending conflicts like Iraq or Afghanistan. Bringing the draft back is never going to happen, thankfully," and he puts a parenthetical question mark, "is there any way we can rebuild a similar alarm about a shitty war we have no business fighting, like what went off during Vietnam?" Catherine, maybe you can answer that question against the backdrop of the House of Representatives, the so-called House of Representatives on Friday, passing into the National Defense Authorization Act, a provision to make registration for the Selective Service automatically done by government for our 18 to 26-year-old males, or 18-year-old males until their age 26, as opposed to having to mail a card in.
Listen, I do think it's true that having a volunteer army makes it easier for politicians to start wars. I do think that's true. But I do think there's like a two wrongs don't make a right situation here. So, you know, when you say, is abolishing the draft the greatest gift we could have given to the military-industrial complex? Like, maybe, but probably more importantly, it was the greatest gift we could have given to men age 18 to 26 who are now not going to go die in a war against their will. And that's like the more important gift. So I think it's like you got to kind of keep perspective. There are many, many ways that we could check presidents or the U.S. government generally in getting involved in wars that we shouldn't be involved in, and reinstituting the draft in order to put the fear of God and man into the American populace is not the way. I don't actually think that this letter writer is proposing that per se, but that is the line of thinking that this reasoning takes us down. And clearly the House of Representatives is quite open to it.
Nick, in addition to just answering the question, maybe point to, is this like a retelling of the history of Vietnam, like correct, do you think? Of
the popular, I don't think so. And one of the things that this letter writer spurred me to do was to look a little bit at what was the effect, who got drafted and who got killed in wars when it was a draft. And World War II is a bizarre outlier in this. 30% of men of draft age were drafted. So, you know, phenomenally more people were drafted. So you can't really draw many comparisons from that. But if you look at Korea and Vietnam, and you look at the first Gulf Wars and things like that, and I looked for a couple articles about this, the fact is that the people who ended up actually serving and dying were disproportionately lower income people with fewer opportunities. So that the draft status did not do much to, you know, it the idea that a draft army, everybody serves. So like, you know, Richard Nixon's daughters are going to go to Vietnam. So like he wouldn't have that other, you know, it doesn't actually work that way. It's also not clear that the number of deployments of soldiers in the all-volunteer era has increased. What has increased is that the length that soldiers serve or armed forces serve during deployments has gone up. But that's mostly because we're participating in stupid wars. So I think the issue of whether or not you have a volunteer or a draft army is almost completely separate from foreign policy decisions. And the one thing that we should definitely come back to, especially if Republicans who are, you know, starting to flirt with the idea of national, you know, a draft or some kind of national service program or whatnot, is to understand that these are always and everywhere terrible ideas, especially during peacetime. You know, that's one of the weirdest things, is that we should have ended the draft after World War II, and instead it stayed in place until 1973. That's a policy decision that was very bad, and also probably allowed Vietnam to ramp up more quickly than it would have otherwise. And then just, you know, we were talking about Congress at various points, not just in this episode, but through the entire existence of this. The real big issue here is that we need to get back to a place where Congress is actually involved in declaring wars rather than presidents.
J.D. Vance, who's a vice president, senator.
And who served in the military.
And who served. He's talked about having at least mandatory service so that people have skin in the game, which is a similar notion. Donald Trump has rejected the concept outright, which I think is good. Peter, how do you respond to the question?
So just very literally, the greatest gift ever given to the military-industrial complex was tens and tens of trillions of taxpayer dollars to build bombs and drones and guns and other stuff. So I don't think the draft is the greatest gift. If you wanted to convince me that maybe we should have a draft, this is probably the route to do it, because this is basically my position about taxes, which is that, in fact, as long as the government is as big as it is, as long as it is spending as much as it is, we should be taxing people more, because the deficit spending that we have acts as a kind of subsidy on big government, because people don't feel it directly. That is the argument that's built into this, and I think it's a reasonable one. It makes makes sense in a lot of ways. But like Nick said, there's not actually a whole lot of evidence that it works. Also, the draft. No, fuck that. Not having it.
This is Milton Friedman all the way down here, because you could argue that one reason people are less sensitive to how much the U.S. government spends is because of withholding, right? We never see our money. When we do pay our taxes, it just disappears from our paychecks. Milton Friedman, thank you for that, sir. But also probably the greatest thing he did, and I think the greatest thing he said he did, was his work in abolishing the draft. So it's all really Milton Friedman.
A couple of points. One is that since the abolition of the military draft, we have much, 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 much fewer casualties of war, American casualties of war. I've said this before, but the number of American servicemen and women who died in Vietnam in just the year 1968 exceeds the number who have died in all post-Vietnam wars combined. And I think abolishing the draft is part of that. That is a good part of that. I also associate myself completely with the comments from Ilya Soman, George Mason, blogs a lot at Bullock Conspiracy at thereason.com site. We are not the property of the government, of a majority of the population, or of some employer. Mandatory national service is a frontal attack on that principle because it is a form of forced labor, literally so. Yeah, it's just that. Once you say it's the principle that the government has some right to your body is as fundamental as it gets, and it should be opposed with vehemence. The Selective Service should be thrown in the trash. It was revived in a panic by Jimmy Carter in 1980 because he was frantically trying to look tough against the evil Soviet Union when it invaded Afghanistan, thereby leading to the cancellation of the 1980 Olympics, or at least American participation in it in Moscow, which is just a catastrophic mistake, as Nick Gillespie well knows. No, we don't do that. It's not an acceptable cost ever to put up individual Americans as cannon fodder for anybody's schemes, including in those schemes of like, I will sacrifice your body in the name of, I hope that that's going to motivate you to agree with me that war is bad. No, you're going to have to use a better argument than that. You're talking about depriving people's liberty. That is as fun to fucking mental as it gets. All right. Sorry for the cussing Fred Young. Let's go to the next part of this podcast, which is that even though it feels like a lifetime ago, Hunter Biden was convicted last week on 3 counts of doing the same thing. Actually, 3 counts that derived from doing the same thing, which is being a crackhead filling out a gun application. This now means that he faces a maximum of 25 years in prison, although the sentencing hasn't happened. It'll certainly be something more than that. We've talked about this in the past, including last week, so we don't need to linger over long. But let's go on a little round of one big takeaway each, starting with Nick Gillespie.
People's responses, and by people, I mean the media's responses to fast-breaking news, is almost completely soaked, or as you would say, Matt, marinated in partisanship. The only way to predict how somebody is going to respond to a big conviction or indictment or anything like that, it seems, or a Supreme Court ruling, is almost always, if we're talking about the media, is what result they wanted and how they think this is either going to help or hurt their political agenda.
So what is an example or like a category of response that you are alluding to in this case, Nick?
People who talk about the need for clemency for Hunter Biden, or how this is not a meaningful prosecution, blah, blah, blah. If the situation is flipped and it's, I don't know, Neil Bush or, Donald Nixon or somebody, then they would be like, no, you know what? The law is the law and we're just following the law. Things like that.
Neil Bush reference for the win, as far as I'm concerned. Peter, what's your one big takeaway from this?
I like how he managed to get 3 convictions for what is essentially 1 action. It's like when you forget to take out the trash and your spouse gets mad at you, not just the one time, but then like again the next week, and then like again the month later, right? It's like, you just did it once. You should only be punished. No, it's just, I think my takeaway is that if you are the son of a sitting president, I don't know, maybe don't write a book about how you were addicted to crack while you're also owning, buying a gun and reporting it lost to police.
Hunter has just, it feels like a lifetime of questionable decisions. Nick, I don't know where he stands on your list of unfortunate presidential offspring, but I gotta imagine he's top five at least at this point.
Unfortunately, what's disappointing about the current election is we're not going to have a new cast of characters. That's the wild card of a new person being president. You always get that secret family tree, which
we need more wacky siblings and children. I mean, the other thing about this is maybe this is just what I was saying earlier about like the weariness of the courts. Like reading about this case, one is struck over and over by the spectacular number of unforced errors. Like just over and over and over, everyone involved in this case was like, okay, let me write a memoir about my time as a crackhead just to really carefully document the timeline of my drug use against the timeline of my gun purchases. There's also the decision by Hallie Biden to throw the gun in the trash, which then
in a grocery store dumpster,
which then forces Hunter Biden's hand. They end up admitting to the existence of the gun because they are worried that they've like put it in bad hands. And it's just like move after move after move.
It depends on what grocery store dumpster, you know. It's like it's different if it's Costco versus if it's Winn-Dixie.
What is the most responsible grocery store dumpster in which to dispose of your illegal firearms?
Oh, a Whole Foods, definitely. You
know, Gelson's. That's, Gelson's.
A Meijer, maybe.
Right. Erewhon, maybe?
Oh, no. No way. Nobody mentally stable is paying that much for a smoothie. I just want to reiterate, though, like
if you have a gun, you could just hold them up for the smoothie.
And it would still like the time served would still be like less onerous than how much you have to pay. 20 million Americans are committing the same felony that Hunter Biden is in trouble for right now. If you buy survey data on drug use and gun ownership, it is clearly selective prosecution, but the selection is partially political and partially just for like top tier idiocy. And I think it's hard to disaggregate those two.
I was on CNN this past week on a panel show reacting, I think, on the day of it or closer to the day of it. And to Nick's point about like you can predict the response of people depending on what team they're playing for or affiliate with. I just find it shocking that when you say something banal, I think, almost or tautological, that both Donald Trump's conviction and Hunter Biden's conviction involved crimes in which there is no victim, and therefore maybe we should stop cheering about it. When you say that, people are like, wow, I never thought of that. like literally had people like, I'm in surprise agreement with you, weirdo libertarian over there. I think it's like it is.
Everyone is always surprised to be in agreement with a libertarian.
Granted, and you know, and certain of us more than others, I presume. But like, it's also like per Catherine's comment about the Supreme Court case, it's such like kind of common sense that I think people have been echo chambering themselves into this like weird magical reality that doesn't make sense to people who are outside of the bubble. Like it's kind of obvious. This stuff is politicized. People's reaction to it is politicized, and it is whenever the government decides that it wants to prosecute you, or whenever a prosecutor decides that, there's just an enormous stack of potential laws and complicating and adding charges to the same thing. 34 counts for a single act in Donald Trump's case. Each one comes with its own penalty. It's ridiculous. Of course it's ridiculous. What are you people even doing? And then when you mention that, people are like, huh? Wow, that's interesting. I think we need to have more that's interesting moments, and that's our role here as otherwise powerless libertarians is to point this out repeatedly over the next 5-6 months as we get deep into the stupid of national politics.
Well, definitely do this because this is going to be the last election. So, you know,
and the most
anything
important
you have to say
lifetime.
About elections, right. Say it before November.
That's right. Catherine, you were saying something?
It's the most important election of our lifetimes as well, just to be clear.
Thank you. I was waiting to hear that. Let's go to our end of podcast, what we've all been consuming in the cultural arena. Peter Suderman, why don't you lead us off?
I watched Hitman, the new movie from Texas filmmaker Richard Linklater on Netflix. It's a kind of true story about an undercover, he wasn't actually a police officer, but someone helping the police in Louisiana he's a college professor, and he started helping the police do prosecutions of people who were trying to do murder for hire. He was just the tech guy. He was setting up the microphones and the cameras. And then he ended up as the person who was the undercover agent who was posing as a hitman so that he could get the people to say, "I want you to kill that guy for money." And part of what this movie really, really emphasizes is there is no such thing as a professional hitman. If you have contacted someone and are offering them money to kill someone else for you because you need someone dead in your life and are willing to pay for it, that person is almost certainly scamming you or a police officer who is trying to entrap you. And it's true. It's like C.J. Sierra Mellon's piece from a couple of years ago. You know, if you're like that starts with this idea of like, if you're like a person with a little bit fringy politics, kind of a radical, and you meet some really helpful stranger who just appears super enthusiastic about all of your crazy, strange beliefs, and that person wants to help you do some terrorism, some like stuff with guns and bombs and maybe like a federal building as a target, that person, probably a fed. So same deal with hitmen. Like if you meet somebody who you want and you want that person to kill somebody and they're like, "Yeah, sure, I'll do it. You just pay me the $10,000. Probably a cop. Anyway, the movie turns into a kind of cute romantic comedy after, yeah, sure. Yeah, after the Glenn Powell fake hitman character meets a young woman who wants her abusive bad husband killed, and he in his hitman persona is like, "That's a bad idea. You don't really want to do that. Take the money you were going to pay me. Go live your life." And they meet again later, and the next time they meet, he is continuing to play his hitman persona, this other version of him. And she falls in love with the persona version, of course, not knowing that he's really just like a dorky, nebbishy college professor who like studies philosophy and psychology and like the idea of the self. Anyway, it's pretty cute. It's pretty charming. And it's on Netflix. You can watch it. It's better than a lot of the movies I've seen in the movie theater this year.
Putting the hit in Hitman or something like that. Nick Gillespie, what did you consume?
I watched the movie version of the Venture Brothers. It's called Radiant is the Blood of the Baboon Heart, and it's the series finale of the Venture Brothers series, which ran on Adult Swim from 2003 to 2018, and is a fantastic metatextual commentary on super science and what I think a lot of boomers and Gen Xers in particular grew up with, a kind of romance of a future that was riffing off of JFK and Star Trek and Johnny Quest and all of that kind of stuff, where we would have a lot of flying cars and we would mostly, the bad people in the world would be escaped Nazis with monocles and pet Komodo dragons driving inexplicably World War One, you know, biplanes or triplanes. So this movie, which came out last year, is the series finale. It has been canceled, and it wraps everything up in this series, which is, if you're into comic books, if you're into things like Johnny Quest, this is the ultimate series, and it is ultimately a meditation on the failure of a kind of 60s great society to deliver on the future that it promised. We have, and I'm forgetting when it's from, it's like 2003 or 2004, Dave Weigel, then at Reason, did a wonderful interview with the series creator, Jackson Publick, for us, which goes deep on this. And I highly recommend Radiant is the Blood of the Baboon Heart. If you love old shitty TV that you grew up with and how the future hasn't quite panned out the way that we were taught to believe that it would.
That show ran on Adult Swim on the Cartoon Network initially, and I just have this theory that Adult Swim is kind of the is like the secret key to culture for the last 25 years in some way that we haven't really grappled with. I mean, it's the Mad Magazine of its era, right? Like, in some way, you can trace absolutely everything back to it if you only experienced American culture by watching Adult Swim, starting with Space Ghost Coast to Coast, which was just the most bonkers, delightful send-up deconstruction of both cartoons and talk shows. You would kind of understand all of America from the late 1990s through now, even if that was all you had seen. Again, in the same way that, like, if you'd only read Mad Magazine, you would in fact kind of know everything about the 1970s and 1980s, even if you hadn't actually experienced the rest of it yourself.
I think I've never seen anything from Adult Swim unless it was when Will Ferrell's baby would like knock on people's doors and start cussing at them.
Have you not seen Too Many Cooks?
I don't know.
Oh man!
Have you not seen Fill in the Blank? The answer is yes. That's Matt Welch. I saw Princess Bride for the first time this weekend.
Grab a drink, take a gummy, and Google "Too Many Cooks." Yeah. What? Just like, and give yourself 15 minutes to absolutely
To put a pin in it, what Adult Swim, and it's broader than it's also the Cartoon Network and even Nickelodeon. But what happened was a bunch of people who came of age during a low point in kind of animated TV shows, in particular in the 70s. And this is partly related to an FCC ruling that kids' shows on Saturday mornings had to be educational, and they became unbelievably shitty and pedantic. And this is why you have the Laugh Olympics, which was to the comedy what the Munich Games were to reconciliation in Germany. And a host of other things like the Super Friends, which are just unbelievably god-awful. People who came of age watching that stuff were able to create the shows that they wanted to watch. They gave them to their kids, and it's a beautiful world of intertextuality and kind of dark humor that is nonetheless as uplifting and radiant as the blood of the baboon heart.
Brack, the character from Space Ghost, is absolutely my personal hero, and anyone who knows the Brack MO will hear that in this podcast.
All I know is that whatever I learned in science, I learned from Electro Woman and Dyna Girl. Speaking of which, Catherine, what did you consume?
I also watched a cartoon. I think that's what we were talking about here. Honestly, I blacked out a little, but
A lot, really.
I went to a movie theater and watched Inside Out 2, the sequel to a Pixar blockbuster that takes place inside the mind of a young girl with different characters representing her various emotions. And it was Inside Out 1, absolutely fantastic. Inside Out 2, also very, 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 very good. I have two thoughts. One is, one of the lessons of the movie is actually very, I think, in line with sort of free range, like, parenting teachings, in that things go wrong when you try to protect your children from everything that is bad in the world. Part of the plot hinges around burying all memories of embarrassment or sadness or shame in ways that create a incomplete person. And I think that is something that a lot of, like, Lenore Skenazy's work and even Jonathan Haidt's work in its best form really get to. So probably a good thing for people to hear that in this era when we are increasingly looking to, for instance, put warning labels on social media so the children won't be sad. My other takeaway from this movie is, if you enjoy the dynamic on this podcast, frankly, like, the dynamic of the life inside of this girl's brain as she hits puberty will be familiar to you. I'm not saying which of you is which character, but on my good days, I'm joy, and on my bad days, I'm anxiety, and that's all I'll say about that.
Wait, no, you have to, you now have to tell us which of us is which of the emotions.
I mean,
you got to do this live on the show for everyone.
I'm absolutely not going to do that, but if people...
You have to publish this afterwards, then.
Donate to Reason.com or become Reason Plus members and then send me an email. Maybe I will send my pics to you. How about that? A little incentive between webathons.
Pay to play.
Pay to play. Come to a live show and ask me next time we have one.
So speaking of middle-aged men and their emotions, I noticed on, I believe, Friday that the band R.E.M., was inducted into the I had a stopwatch over here. How long can we get to a Nick Gillespie scoff? And it was 1.5 seconds. They're inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Beforehand, there was actually a really great CBS News interview with all four of the members. They've been broken up for 13, 14 years, something like that. And it was the first time that the four of them had sat down. And it was a very moving thing for this middle-aged Gen Xer. R.E.M. was a very important band to me, although you can go entire seasons without listening to anything from them. And like you kind of wonder what all the hype was about. They then played at the awards show. They played Losing My Religion, which was their monster hit from 91. You can see clips of it. Again, very moving. So I went down a big rabbit hole on R.E.M. And the thing that I'm going to recommend to people is an interview released a couple of days ago by the great video podcaster Rick Beato. B-E-A-T-O, like Greg, who is always like breaking down popular music, songs, whatever, and he plays every instrument. He's a very skilled musician and an explainer of things, but he also interviews people. And he interviewed Mike Mills, the bass player, also does a lot of piano and backup singing for R.E.M. And it's just a great interview. It's like 80 minutes long, filled with all kinds of fodder of things to think about way beyond and different from music. It's very kind of generation appropriate. He keeps going back to like the importance that they had from the beginning, since they understood about musical history, of owning all of their masters, having total creative control over everything at every stop, and how their sort of shared vision of four kind of odd people who fit together was not necessarily this is what we want to do, but this is what we don't want to do. And that sort of eventually kind of ended up kind of creating an anti-vision that became a vision. Really super interesting about like organizing yourself artistically and fitting them into the context and ethos of the 80s and then the 90s where they blew up. Great, interesting commentary about Kurt Cobain, who had a relationship with the lead singer Michael Stipe. Bunch of other stuff besides. But a really interesting interview, even if you don't really care that much about R.E.M. Some of it's super music and text and technical, and some of it is not. But Mike Mills is a terrific guy, and just a very, very interesting discussion. So check it out. Mike Mills, The Story of R.E.M. is the name of it. We'll put a link in. Yes, Nick?
Oh, I was going to say we've also reached the age where they now look like the Banana Splits, Matt. So it's kind of great when you see all four of them together. I would add, Rick Beato is a great listen, whatever he's talking about, particularly when he talks about the business of the music industry. But Michael Stipe did a great interview with Rick Rubin on his Broken Record podcast, which is also worth checking out, that came out within the past year or two. Matt, we have talked about R.E.M. I used to be a super fan and then kind of cashed out. They are fascinating to listen to, but that might be, because we're old men at this point and they mean something to us in our youth, but interesting characters.
Jason Isbell, who gave the introduction at the Songwriters Hall of Fame, had two points that I thought were pretty interesting. And I'm nobody's Jason Isbell fan necessarily, although I appreciate his talent. But he said that nobody really covers their songs, which is true and interesting, although which is also true of the Beach Boys, by the way, for kind of similar reasons of it's a bit complicated to play like that. But also that for his experience of listening to it is like listening to this as a weird kid in the South made me feel like that maybe there's other weird kids in the South like me. And you can extend that writ large. I mean, the weird kids anywhere. And then you wake up and realize that everyone thinks that they're a weird kid. And this is the biggest band in the world because of that. Just very interesting. But anyways, enough prattling on about that. That is our podcast for this week. Nick, are we in kind of senescence? Are we in the zombie cell mm-hmm. mode when it comes to live events in New York City? And if not, disabuse me of that notion? And if so, tell us what you got on the podcast coming up.
We've got a lot of stuff coming up on the podcast, including a wonderful interview with John Mackey of Whole Foods. And we've I'm going to be talking to Mike Rowe of Dirty Jobs, who has a patriotic movie coming out that's pretty interesting. We've got a lot of stuff on tap there. Events will be posted as we develop them at reason.com/events.
Terrific. Go to all our podcasts at reason.com/podcast and make sure when you're going to reason.com/donate and you're adding a new donation that you put somewhere near the subject line, Catherine, please tell us which emotions Nick Gillespie are. But we all know who it is. It's the anger bear. Let's be honest.
There are new emotions in Inside Out too. There's more to choose.
Oh, really?
From.
Okay.
Yeah. Really?
Maybe I'll go watch. Okay. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week, and goodbye.